Juanita, it's good to see you. She said Robert made her come tonight. She does not feel well. Robert made her come. He's an elder, and he said to come, and so she came. Did y'all read chapter 6 and 7? Last week we looked at, So far what we've looked at, the first two chapters of Job, the introduction, and all these horrible things that have befallen him. And then, you know, he's been so stoic in how he's handled it. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord. He's lost his health, his wealth, his children, all that remains is his wife, who's not a great help to him. In fact, she's a discouragement. She says, why don't you just curse God and die? And then, you know, he's been so stoic. And then in chapter 3, he opens his mouth. And it's a big difference from what we've read so far in chapter 2, and that Job says pretty much, I wish I had never been born. Or he says, maybe if I had been born, you know, since I was born, I wish I had just died at birth. Why could not I have not come out from the womb and expired? I think that's what he says in chapter 3, verse 11. And so his friends are listening to him. And Eliphaz, the first friend, probably the oldest friend, speaks up and says, Job, 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 you've obviously sinned. Because look at how much you're suffering. Only people that are sinners suffer like you're suffering. Look at what you're going through. You've sinned. Fess up. God will forgive you and God will heal you. And Job, throughout this early part, you know, Job knows he's not perfect. He knows he's not sinless, but he knows, look, I haven't done anything to have all this happen. And so Eliphaz, and it's not unique to him. We said Eliphaz would say, well, you're suffering, therefore you've sinned. This theology is pretty common throughout the world. Remember what Jesus' disciples said in John chapter 9? We talked about it last week. They saw the man born blind and said, somebody sinned. Either he sinned, his parents sinned. And so this idea that bad things happen to bad people. You know, why does this happen? And they just assume that someone has sinned if something bad has taken place. You think we ever think like that today? Or you think that was just them? You know, do you ever... And that's really, you see these televangelists all the time. And I just don't like to name names. Joel Osteen. I can't imagine, and I'm going to get in trouble, but I mean, why? I can't imagine a member of the church like reading from Joel Osteen. I just can't imagine that. I'm just talking out loud to myself. What truths does he teach? I know not one. Isn't that the song, Know Not One, Know Not One? I don't know of any truths that he teaches. I know that he teaches, though, he's one of the forefront, one of the vanguard of the prosperity gospel. Have you heard of that? That's basically this idea that, you know, if you do right, God's going to prosper you with blessings and specifically with money. And so if you're rich, God has blessed you, right? Is that not essentially what Job's friends are arguing? If good things are happening to you, God is happy with you. And if bad things are happening to you, God is displeased. That's what Job's friends argued. That's what Jesus' disciples were flirting with. That's what the televangelists today will preach. Do you think we ever think that, though? Think that, though? When something bad happens to someone, is the first thing. Do you ever even in the back of your mind think, I just wonder if they've done something wrong and God is punishing them? Do you ever let yourself, does that thought ever creep into your mind? We wouldn't admit it, I guess. I wonder if God's punishing them. And you know, you have to balance certain truths in the Bible because the Hebrews writer said that the Lord chastens those that He loves. He disciplines those that He loves. He scourges every son that He receives. And if you be without chastisement, of which all are partakers, then you are fatherless and not sons. And so, yes, the Lord disciplines even His children. And so, you know, sometimes when we suffer, could it be God disciplining us? But the problem is, you cannot make a blanket statement. And that's what Job's friends did. You can't have a one-size-fits-all theology that says when something bad happens to somebody, that's automatically God punishing them, right? Or if something good, if somebody is, you know, somebody is experiencing good things, God is happy with them. His favor is shining upon them. No, bad things happen to good people. Good things happen to bad people. And that's what Job's friends were missing out on. But tonight, what we want to do is notice Job's response. Because Eliphaz has said, Job, fess up. You know you've done something. And let's look at Job's response in these two, chapters 6 and 7. Job says, you know what? I know that I lashed out. I know that I said some rash things. He's going to say that it was rash. But notice his reasoning. Notice his, we'll call it his rationale. Look at verses 2 and 3 in chapter 6. Oh, that my vexation were weighed and my calamity were put in the balances. He said it would be heavier than the sands of the sea. Therefore, my words have been rash. If you were to take everything that I'm going through, have went through, and I'm still going through, and put it on one side of the scale and put all the sands of the seas of the world on the other, my calamity outweighs them all. And he says, that's why. He says, I realize I've said some pretty strong things, but he said there's a reason for it. Right, and what he's doing is he's countering Eliphaz's criticism. What had Eliphaz suggested? He said, Job, you've given people advice. You've gone hither, thither, and yon, telling people, you know, how to handle adversity. But now when it's happened to you, you've fallen apart. The shoe's on the other foot and you've just collapsed. And Job says that's not a fair comparison because what I've counseled people about and what I'm going through now, apples and oranges, hardly the same thing. Now, look at verse 4, because it's at this point, chapter 6, verse 4, that Job first suggests that somehow this has got to do with God. Remember we said this whole book is about wrestling with these God questions that we have, and that if we're honest, we all wrestle with from time to time. Why does God let things happen that seem so, from our vantage point, our limited vantage point, seem unfair? And we wrestle with, and maybe we don't talk about it at church because we don't want folks to think less of us. But in private, in our own thoughts, you know, we wrestle with things. Why would God let that happen? Right? And so look, Job hasn't got it all figured out yet. Job doesn't know what's going on, really, does he? He doesn't know the backstory of what went on in heaven before all this happened about the devil appearing before God. He doesn't know all of that. But he does know from his own experience. He says, I know God has a hand in what goes on in this world. I know God has an active hand in things. But the only thing Job can come up with so far at this early stage is that God is punishing him. Now, somebody says, well, isn't that what Eliphaz said? Eliphaz would agree. That's what I told you. God is punishing you. Job says, I feel like God is punishing me. Eliphaz says, that's exactly what I told you. God is punishing you. But what Job denies is that he deserves it. That's the difference. They both would agree, Job's being punished, but Eliphaz says, you deserve what you're getting. In fact, you deserve worse than you're getting. And Job says, no, I don't. I don't. And this is what Job's struggling with, what he's struggling to reconcile. If God is running the world, why is this happening to me? And don't you know people ask that question today? You say God is good, and you say God is powerful. It's the old supposed conundrum of, if God is all powerful and God is all good, why do these things happen? Is He not powerful enough to restrain it? Right. Well, if He can't stop it from happening, He's not all powerful, He's not all God. Or can He stop it? He is powerful enough, He just doesn't want to. Well, in that case, He's not good. And what people fail to realize is that you can't have contradictions and then apply that to God. Nonsense remains nonsense even when we talk it about God. God can't violate His nature, but God has made us with free will. And I know this stuff is over my head. God didn't make us robots. God gave us freedom of choice, didn't He? God gave us freedom of choice. There's evil in this world, and we can't explain. We don't know all the reasons why things happen. We just don't. We just don't. And that's what Job struggles with. Look at verse 4. He says, "The arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." He says, "I feel like God has made me His dartboard, or God has made me His punching bag. God is like an enemy army that's invading." That's how I feel. But notice he asked four questions, starting, I think, in verse 5. He asked four rhetorical questions so you can see the point he's making. Look at verse 5. "Does the wild donkey bray when he has grass?" Now, how much do you know about wild donkeys? Why does the wild donkey bray? I guess he's complaining. I guess he wants food. Look at the B part. "Does the ox low over his fodder?" Is that when he's making noise? Is that when the ox is lowing? No, it's before he's fed that he's lowing. Look at verse 6. "Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt?" What's the answer to that question? No. No. I knew we used to have, when I preached at Trustful, we would go to eat afterwards. You know people that'll add salt to stuff before they even taste it? It's like, you don't even know how it tastes yet. We would get tortilla chips at the Mexican restaurant that you can bet were salty already. And before you can eat it, just salt it. Just salt it. You know, that's got to be all kinds of healthy. Well, what do you do when you have something that's bland? Look, Amanda's not in here tonight. And I know she doesn't listen to my lesson. So listen to this. This is not about her cooking. I'm not that stupid. But when we would go to Thanksgiving, and everybody's got their own preference. You know, you grow up eating your family's Thanksgiving, and you know, it's just better to you, even if it's like dog food, it's just your dog food and you like it. You know, that ain't how my mama did it. My mama would put, you know, slice up the little eggs in the giblet gravy. You know what? But we'd go to Amanda's side of the family, and they would rave about her grandma's scalloped potatoes. "Oh, scalloped potatoes, she makes the best scalloped potatoes. You never had scalloped potatoes like this." And you know, and then I ate them, and you know, it's like, I got nothing here. I got nothing here. And before I would even get it, I just start adding salt to it. And I know, you know, Amanda will raise a little eyebrow at me. You know, "What are you doing adding salt to these perfect potatoes?" I'm like, "Just leave me alone. He's salty. They need salt. They need salt." And they weren't good, but I can never tell her that. You like those potatoes, and then what do you do then? Boy, I can't wait to have them again next year. In fact, I'm going to wait till then to eat them. But all four of these questions Job is asking, you see the answer is no. Every question, no, 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 no. He's got one more in the B part. Depending on what version you have, it says, "Is there any taste in the juice of a mallow?" Which I have no idea what that even means. If you look at the footnote, it says the Hebrew there is uncertain. So even the translators aren't sure what that means. And then the version I was reading said, "Is there any taste in the white of an egg?" Is there any taste in the white of an egg? Why is Job asking four questions and the answer to all of them is no? Job hungry and talking about food? No. He says there's a reason. Why does a donkey bray? He's hungry. When does the ox low? Does he low when he has his food? No, he does it before then. Can you eat something bland without salt? No. Is there any taste in the white of an egg? He says, I'm making a lot of noise and I realize that I'm saying some pretty strong stuff. But you know why I'm doing it? There's a reason. Do you think I would be doing this if nothing was happening? Would I be talking out like this if everything was going normal in my life? No, I would not. So since I am speaking out, there must be a reason. That's what he's saying. I have a reason to be upset. And wouldn't we be upset as well if we were Job? Now look at what he says, beginning in verse 8. Job has a request. And what is his request? What's he want? I thought I heard it. Does he want to have a Bible study with someone? What's he want? He wants to die. Yeah, he wants to die. A lot of times people have rough times, but they don't want to die on the spot, do they? People will endure hardship because they got a family that's depending on them. They have children who are depending on them. But Job doesn't have any children now, does he? You know? He's going to say, what do I have to live for? Do you ever read this and think, I see what he's going through. He says, look, what do I have to live for? And if I'm in this much pain, if this is how every day is, Lord, just finish me off. Just finish me off. Now, what do we need to appreciate in this section? What do we need to appreciate? How would you describe Job's mood here? What would you say? One word, starts with D, ends with D. Yeah, he's depressed. Depression. Right? And that's not a laughing matter, is it? You know? This is more than just a case of the blues or the blahs, you know? And I'm sure not asking for a show of hands. But have you ever been depressed before? And I said, no, everybody gets down occasionally, you know? Ever been depressed? Ever felt like that before? They used to tell preachers to avoid confessional type statements when they preach, and don't tell people anything, like try to avoid that. And I think there's some merit to that, honestly, because if I'm telling the truth, I wouldn't want to hear a preacher get up every time they preach and tell me what they're going through and all their aches and pains and everything. I don't want to hear that every time somebody preaches. I remember someone getting up one time and crying through their whole lesson. And it was, you know, it's like, what are you going to preach or are you going to cry? That sounds mean to me to say, doesn't it? And doesn't that sound mean? You know, but I'll tell you this. I can remember when my sister passed away 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago. It was May of 2013. And the very next, she, you know, 54 years old. That was unexpected. And it was the very next month that I came here and did the VBS, taught the adult VBS. And, you know, I did not feel at my best. But you don't tell people, you know, you're going to come do the VBS. Well, I don't feel real good. My sister just died, but I'm going to come do VBS. You just do it. You just keep your mouth shut and do it. You know, that's what you do. And I felt pretty good. I didn't feel great, but I felt okay. It was about October of that year. I think it took a few months just to catch up to me. But I remember going, I was speaking at Arab, not Arab. You know, it's Arab in Alabama. It's like a friends and family type deal. And I remember, you know, I get chauffeured everywhere I go. I mean, I just get to sit in the passenger seat everywhere I go, riding in style. I remember telling Amanda on the way there, I said, I feel like I am in a fog. I said, I just feel like right now, it's like I've got to go speak at Friends and Family Day. And I didn't realize it. You don't know the truth. I said, I think I may have mono. I think I've got some kind of virus. Because you know what all I wanted to do when I got home from school was go to bed. Amanda says, looking back on it, she didn't tell me at the time it would have been good to know. She said, you were ill. You were cranky. I mean, that's my default setting. So you're going to have to be more specific when you say that. She said, no, you would come home, you would be ill. I could tell you didn't want to be around the kids. You just kind of went to your room. I remember going to bed like 7 o'clock, which is early for me, going to bed, going to work, coming home, going to bed, coming home, just feeling like you're in a daze. And that was right around the time. Sometime in all of there, I got invited to come here to join the work here. Robert's looking at me now like we are going to reevaluate your employment as soon as this. He's looking at me like, where is this? But I remember, you know, sometime that summer, I don't remember exactly when it was broach, and then PTP was coming up, and so that got pushed, you know, to the back burner. And then sometime later that year, I was offered to come on here, and I gave my 90 days notice at Asheville. But I'm going to tell you the truth, and I would pray about it. There were times I thought, boy, I hope I get feeling better before January. I started preaching here January of 2014. I remember thinking, Lord, I hope I get feeling better before January 2014 because I feel like damaged goods. That's what I felt like. I said, I feel like, and I would come, and I normally would love to study the Bible, love to read and write and all, and I thought, I had no desire. I couldn't even concentrate. You know, I'd pick up something and read it, close it. You know, and looking back on it, at the time, I just, like I said, I had no perspective. I thought, man, I'm just overworked or I'm just tired. You know what I think? I think I was depressed. I think I was depressed. And I thought, Lord, I hope I get feeling better, because now I'm leaving one job, leaving Clay Chalkville, going to Oxford, leaving Asheville, going to Jacksonville. And I don't think they're going to have a lot of patience with me if I show up and I'm like, I'm just really not feeling well. You got to go. You know. And so I think, and I said all that to say, and that's really a minor thing, you know. I had a friend say to me, he said, you are going to make it through. He said, you just keep on plugging. You are going to make it through. I was glad for that encouragement. And, you know, things got better. I feel so much better. But I can appreciate, you know, not to the extent that he was. Good night, he had lost 10 children, lost his health. But, you know, we some things you can't see in people. And I told you last week what Wendell Winkler said about people wearing, what did he say? Everyone wears an inner garment of sackcloth. I think that's what it was. And you don't, you wouldn't know that, you know? I mean, I didn't, did you know when I came here, you know, and did the VBS? Oh, you seem like you're down, Brandon. No, you didn't know. You didn't know me anyway. You know, you don't know what people are going through unless they tell you. Job's depressed. Look at verse 8, chapter 6. Oh, that I might have my request and that God would fulfill my hope. Well, what is that? Verse 9, that it would please God to crush me. I wish you would just finish me off and crush me, as if God, it's like God's just holding on to him, being with him just enough to keep him alive. And he says, I wish you'd just finish me off. Drop down to verse 10, we'll be there in a second. But what Job agonizes over here is the prolonged uncertainty of it all. Have you ever felt that way? You don't have to answer out loud. Have you ever felt, look, I don't know what's going on with me. I don't know why it's happening. I don't know how long this is going to go. But here's the thing, I don't know how much more I can take. You ever felt like that? I don't know how much more of this I can take. That's a hopeless feeling, isn't it? If you've ever felt that way, it's a hopeless feeling. He doesn't know how long he's going to linger, but his thought is this, I just want to die. But now he's not saying, I'm just going to turn my back on God. I'm going to, like his wife suggested, curse God and die. He doesn't have any concerns about this, because look at verse 10. He said, I have not denied the words of the Holy One. That's God. So Job's not saying, I want to die and be lost. He says, I know that I have not done anything to merit what I'm going through. And I feel like I've not turned my back on God, and there'll be a reward for me. In that case, just let me die. I'm not afraid of the consequences. But don't you know to his friends that was like fingernails on a chalkboard? Because what's their whole point? No, you look at you, you wouldn't be going through what you're going through if you hadn't sinned. And now here you are saying you want to die. You better not say that, because when you die, Job, in this situation, you know where you're headed, right? And Job says, no, I haven't denied the words. But look at verse 12, or look at verse 11, I'm sorry. What is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should be patient? In other words, what do I have to hope for? And your heart just goes out to Job in verse 12. He asks, is my strength the strength of stones, or my flesh bronze? What's he saying? How would we say that, especially that B part of, is my flesh bronze? You read that and think, so he's talking about being tanned? What's he talking about? What's he saying in our own vernacular? I'm not made of what? I'm not made of steel. Right? I'm flesh. I'm not made of steel. I can't take it anymore, is what he's saying. And he says one of the reasons why is he feels like he has no help. He has no resource. In other words, he says, I've got no hope of this turning around. The way I feel right now, I've got no hope of this turning around. And so then he turns to his friends, and you know this has been bottled up. In verse 14, Job turns his attention to his friends and he rebukes them. And if you listen to what he says, you can see what's really upsetting him here. Look at verse 14. He turns to those three, because these really is plural. It's not just Eliphaz, but Bildad and Zophar. He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. He says, Eliphaz, do you know what you should have done? You know, it would have been nice, Eliphaz, if you could have just shown a little compassion. You're supposed to be my friend. And when you don't show kindness to a friend, it's a character flaw. It's a sign. You know, to their credit, they came and they sat with Job because they were concerned about him, but their whole theology, isn't it sad when these were religious folks, but their religion led them to be unkind? They failed to do the simplest thing and show kindness. I remember reading somewhere, it was William Barclay, who knows what book that it was in, but he said, unless a man's Christianity makes him kind, it is not real. Isn't that something? You know, I memorized the plan of salvation and I know verses for it, which is good, but then we're not kind. Unless your Christianity makes you a kind person, what's your religion doing for you, really? Drop down to verse 27. He said, you would cast lots upon the fatherless. You would bargain over your friend. You would cast lots over orphans. Is that really the kind of men they are? Is that what Job is saying? He's saying your ideas have led you astray. And he kind of couches it in the idea, you would mistreat an orphan just to hold on to your doctrine. Do you know people today that hold to false ideas and religion, false doctrines, whatever it may be, and rather than let go, you could show them some absurdity about that doctrine, but they would rather hold on to the doctrine than acknowledge the absurdity. Does that make sense? Ever heard of the saints-only doctrine? You don't hear of it much these days. It's pretty much been weeded out, but there's a group of brethren that believe that you can only help Christians from the church treasury, so to say. I know I'm pointing towards the baptistry, the church treasury. But you can't help, they would argue, you cannot help non-Christians in benevolence from the church treasury. Now, you could help them in spiritual things. If you came across a non-Christian and you wanted to give them a tract or a Bible, they would say that that's okay. But they would say that benevolence-wise, helping them with a physical need, they say you can only help Christians from the church treasury. Now, if you want to take out your wallet as an individual and contribute to them, this non-Christian, you may as an individual. But as the church, collectively, they argue that we cannot. And that's really just a bunch of gnat-straining, camel-swallowing, you know, Pharisaism. Because think about this. Try to illustrate this. Think about if we were passing out tracts in Jacksonville and we're going door to door and we come across a family, they're not Christians, but they're interested in the gospel. They'd like to learn more about the gospel, but the father's just lost his job, the mother's 8 months pregnant, and their electricity's just been turned off and they've got mouths to feed. And you don't think that happens, it does. Now, are you telling me that as we go door to door, door knocking there, that we could leave them a tract and we could say, we sure do hope this works out for you and here's a Bible for you to read, but we cannot, as members of the church, ameliorate their physical needs and we couldn't give to them? And they'd say, well, if you wanted to give out of your wallet individually, are you telling me that as a church we could not help their need? Isn't that ridiculous? Isn't that ridiculous? But you can show scenarios like this to our saints-only brethren and it doesn't move them. They'll say, well, you can do it as an individual, but you can't do it as a church. Well, then what is a church composed of but individuals? And if I can do it as an individual, and two of us can do it as individuals, why couldn't we do it as a church? But Job says, you've got this theology in your head, and your theology is bad things happen to bad people, and you see me suffering, that means I must be bad. And you've got no proof for it, you've got no evidence for it, you've just got your theology, but rather than turn it around because you've got no evidence, you're just bound determined to cling to it. That's what he's telling them. You'd rather cling to your doctrines than be kind to your friend. And that's when you know your religion's got you in trouble, if your religion's leading you to be unkind. Right? And that's what he's telling them. Now look at verse 28. It gets pretty intense here. He said, look at me. Now therefore be pleased to look at me. I shall not lie to your face. Now you have to wonder if his friends were not even looking at him. Right? Maybe they weren't even looking at him. So finally he says to them, I want you to turn around and look at me. You look me in the eye. In those dark, sunken eyes. Right? He says, I would not lie to you. This is intense, isn't it? You picture yourself in that setting. Verse 29, turn now. My integrity is at stake. My vindication is at stake. Verse 30, is there any injustice on my tongue? Cannot my palate discern the cause of my suffering, the cause of my calamity? I'm especially looking at the B part there. Cannot my palate discern the cause of my calamity? Reads kind of awkwardly. In other words, Job says, don't you guys think that if I had done something, if I had committed some egregious sin that brought all this down on my head, don't you think I'd be the one to know about it? Wouldn't I be the one to know about it if I'd done something wrong and all this happened? I would know it more than y'all would. Well, I'm telling you that I haven't. And how would you know better than me? Now look at chapter 7. Job starts talking out loud to himself. It's like his friends are there, but he's kind of talking out loud to himself about a couple of things. One, how hard his life is, and two, some problems that he has or some questions that he has about God. He says, "My days are awful. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. My days are spent in misery." Then he says in verse 4, "When I lie down and say, 'When shall I arise?' The night is long and I'm full of tossing until the dawn. My flesh is clothed with worms," he says. "My skin hardens and then it breaks out again. My days are awful. I lie down at night thinking I'll get some rest, and I'm just tossing and I'm just turning all night." He says, you know, some people at least have something to hope for, but my life is full of nothing but distress. Circle verse 7 in your Bible, because in verse 7 of chapter 7, Job makes a transition to a spiritual dimension here. He's talking about God, even though God's name doesn't appear. Verse 7, "Remember that my life is breath. My eye will never see good again." Can you enter into what Job is thinking here? It's like Job is saying, or let me ask you this. Is Job saying this? Is Job saying, you know, if I can just hang in there a few more months, things will get better. You know, I'm starting to feel better. My throat is not as sore as it was, and my fever seems to be going away. Is that what Job is saying? No, no, no. He says, there is no hope. There is no hope. Look at verse 8. "The eye of him who sees me will behold me no more. While your eyes are on me, you, God, I'll be gone." Look at verse 11. Job feels like this. I've already lost my 10 kids. And I see where Job thinks in his mind. Now, we know the end of the story and Job doesn't. But Job in his mind thinks, this is going to lead to my death. And we would think the same thing if we were in his shoes. Why? What reason do you have to think it's going to get better? Look what's happened to you. This is going to lead to your death, Job. That's what he thinks. We would think it too. But look at verse 11. "Therefore, I will not restrain my mouth. I will speak in the anguish of my spirit. I will complain in the bitterness of my soul." Job says, that's why I won't be quiet. That's why Job has removed his filter, so to speak. Verse 12, and if you read verses 12 to the end of the chapter, and this is what I want to talk about, even though we've got like 10 minutes. Robert, what's the official time left? 8 minutes? 11. Job says in verse 12, "Am I the sea?" He's talking to God. "Am I the sea, or am I a sea monster that you," that's God, "that you set a guard over me? Am I that dangerous? Do you really, God, do you really have to watch me that close?" He knows that God rules the world. So why is this happening to me? Have you ever felt that way? Look at verse 13. Job says, "When I say my bed will comfort me and my couch shall ease my complaint." You know, at least sometimes you can go to sleep. If you can go to sleep, you can kind of escape reality for a while, but not Job. Job says, "When I tell myself I'll go to bed for a little while and my couch will ease my complaint," he says, "then you scare me with visions. You scare me with these terrors." Remember, Eliphaz had told him about a vision he had seen. A vision came to me at night and I saw, and Job says, "When I think about trying to get some sleep, then you try to scare me and give me nightmares." Right? Look at verse 19. He's addressing this out loud to God. "How long will you not look away from me, nor leave me alone until I swallow my spit?" God, you are watching me like a hawk every second, every minute, and not in a good way. You know, we quote, the verses, the eyes of the Lord are over the righteous and His ears are open to their prayers. Job says, you are watching me every second like a hawk, but not in a good way, in a bad way. He says in verse 20, boy, this is strong. If I sin, okay, let's say I've sinned. They're charging me with sin, my friends. He says, if I sin, what do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? He's calling God that. Let's say I have sinned. I'm a human. I'm nothing. You're God. If I sin, what is it to you? What do I do to you, you watcher of mankind? What's it to you if I've sinned? Look at the B part. Why have you made me your mark? Why have you made me a target? Why have I become a burden to you? Now let me ask you this. Is Job wrestling with some hard questions? Does Job have some unanswered God questions? And the thing is, and hear this, I guess. Hear this. Job here is speaking foolishly. Job here is speaking, dare I say it, he's speaking very stupidly because he is hurting. And this is what, remind yourself of this. I'll come back to this. Remind yourself of this fact. What Job is saying about God here is wrong. Job should not have said what he said. What Job says about God is wrong. God wasn't doing this to him. Satan was doing this to him. But let me ask you this, when you read these verses, do you find yourself a little bit kind of identifying with Job and what he says? Or are you kind of glad Job said what he said? Are you kind of identifying with what he said? Because we hurt too. Right? You read these things, you're like, that's a good point, Job. And then you remind yourself everything he said here is wrong. He's made some very, very, serious charges against God, and his charges are wrong. And yet we read them and go, yeah, that's right. It's not right. Right? But he's human, and we are human as well. Look at verse 21. He says, okay, if I've sinned, why do you not just pardon my transgression? Take away my iniquity, for now I will lie down in the earth, and you will seek me, and I shall not be. Job gets a little sarcastic here, I think. And it's like Job is saying, you know what, God? You know what? One of these days, you're going to turn around and I'm going to be gone. And you're not going to have old Job to kick around anymore. You've been kicking me around. You've made me your target. You've made me your mark. You're shooting arrows at me. But I'm going to tell you what, God, one of these days, I'm gone. And who are you going to pick on then? Who are you going to pick on then? Because I'll be gone. You'll seek me and I won't be. Why won't you just forgive me? If I've sinned against you, God, why won't you just let it go? He's struggling. He's struggling because he can't reconcile what he believes about God and what he learned in Bible class all his life, right? Here's what Job learned growing up. Here's what Job knows is true. He knows in his heart these things about God that are true. But how do I reconcile this with what I see firsthand in my life? That's, the juxtaposition there. That's the thing that's hard for him. I know God's good. I've learned all my life. He loves me. But why, if that's true, is he letting this happen to me? That's real life, isn't it? That's real life. I think that's why God let this book be in the Bible. I think that's why these things happen to begin with. Because God knew we would have these same questions. And I don't think God is terribly afraid when we ask them. Right? God doesn't stop being God. Oh no, they've questioned something. Well, no, I'm no longer God. They've questioned something. No, God knows we're human and we have questions. I recall Jesus on the cross. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? Isn't that interesting that Jesus Christ asked that question? Could it be that Jesus so completely identifies with us? He identifies with us in our pain and our suffering, that Jesus wanted to identify with us so completely that when we ask, why, God, why are you letting this happen? And we see Jesus Christ, God's Son, says, God, why? Why? I feel, God, like you've forsaken me. And Jesus loves us, doesn't he? And God loves us. Now, quickly, I wanted to give three quick takeaways. You know, what do we learn from this? Well, we need hope. Hope helps us persevere. Hope helps us think that better days are ahead. But you know what? If all the things that we hope for are for things to be resolved in this life, then our hope is short-sighted, isn't it? You know, we have, ultimately, we know we have the hope of heaven. That's the ultimate victory. But we need hope right now, don't we? We need hope even now that we can overcome sin and overcome temptation, overcome addiction, overcome adversity and distress. And in Christ, we can overcome. We need that hope. We need that encouragement that we can. We need faith, strong faith. What is faith? It's believing who God is, who He said He is, believing what He said. And this was one of Job's problems. I wanted to say this. I guess if you get nothing else, I hope you get this. Job's faith had some holes in it along the way. Job had a good foundation. Job had a good foundation of faith. But there were some problems with his faith, and it made some things seem irreconcilable. And one of the things we learn from seeing the big picture here is that God doesn't treat us as adversaries. He treats us as His children. But God may allow us to experience suffering and hardship along the way. But now listen, this is what I wanted you to hear. He allows us, even though He loves us, to experience bad things in life, suffering and hardship. But these things, these bad things, are not indicators in and of themselves that God is displeased with you. You're suffering. That does not mean God is displeased with you, but that's all that Job could see. There was the hole in his faith. If we have a strong faith, if we build that foundation, we can see that bad things are not automatically God being upset or displeased with us. God loves us. Case in point, look at Jesus Christ. Did Jesus ever have any hardship? Did Jesus ever have any suffering that He endured? And that's what I wanted to say. We need this foundation because we're going to need real answers to God's questions when we face the storms of life. We need to know that even though I'm facing tough times, that doesn't mean God's abandoned me or it's happened to me because He doesn't love me. And I learned that from Job. Finally, quickly, we need love. And this is where Job's friends really fell down on the job. A preacher told the story, and I'll close with this. A preacher told the story about a member of his congregation being in the final months of her illness. Just a few months left before she died. He went to see her and she was crying. And she said to him, she asked him, "Why did God leave me like this? I wish I could have just died. Why didn't God just let me die? Why has He left me to linger like this? I just wish I could have died." What would you have said to her? If she had said that to you and you had been there visiting her, why has God left me like this? Why didn't He just let me die? What would you say to her? Would you say, well, sister, we must understand that sometimes God permits suffering to make us stronger. Is that what she needs to hear? Is that what she needs to hear? No. No. And in that moment of suffering, what did Job need to hear from his friends? In that moment of pain and distress, what did Job need to hear? Maybe he needed to hear from his friends, "We don't know why you're going through this, Job." You know, we can know theoretically up here, "I know God's not doing this to me." We can even verbalize it to our friends, "I know God's not punishing me. I know that He's not doing this to me. I know from my Bible that God's not doing this to me." But be honest with yourself. In your heart of hearts, don't you sometimes cry out, "Why? Why is this happening?" You know what people need? They need compassion, right? They need friends that will say to them, "I don't know why this is happening, but I do know that God loves us." Right. I do know that He will help us, and I do know that we have hope. One day when we make it to heaven, He is going to make everything all right. People need kindness. They need compassion in their hour of grief. That's the lesson I think we need to learn from Job's failed friends on this point. We need to make ourselves available to loving Christian fellowship, and we need to display compassion to others when they're hurting. We need to be kind. We need to show love. Well, Robert, I am like a minute over, but we finished chapters 6 and 7. We're going to skip all the way ahead because there's like 28 chapters of this dialogue, and I did not want to bog down in Job, you've sinned, confess it, and Job saying, no, I have not. We're going to skip ahead to chapter 32 for next Wednesday night. 32 through 37 is when the fourth friend enters the picture, Elihu. So if you want to read those six chapters for next week, 32 to 37, I appreciate it.